Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbiton.
Hey, good morning, good morning. What we, of course, must give our listeners a very special greeting today, because this is the last On the Menu program before the Christmas holiday, and we're still hoping that we'll be in celebrating in style in New Orleans, Louisiana. Boy, I had trouble getting that one.
Yeah, it's a little too early.
New Orleans
is the way it's pronounced.
It's curious. I just got an email from Ralph Brennan.
Yeah.
Saying times have been slow in the fall in New Orleans, so they're looking for people to still plan to come for holidays. They said they are expecting it to be kind of crazy around New Year's Day, which is when the Sugar Bowl is played. So I think we'll be in and out of there before then. Because if you remember that wonderful time we got stuck in traffic because we forgot about the Bayou Classic, which is the day after Thanksgiving, and we were coming in by cab from the airport and traffic was totally at a standstill. We finished up walking to our hotel because the cab couldn't get any further.
Yeah.
I remember there was a horse-mounted policeman trying to clear people out of the McDonald's on Canal Street. It was quite a scene. So,
yeah, but I don't think New Orleans is that busy.
They expect it to be busy around that time, and we certainly hope so. And we're told it's a wonderful place for Christmas, and So we're hoping that we might enjoy it. And in the meantime, on the subject of a new program, yeah. Shall we do that?
Yeah, except I wanted to mention, though, that our son's birthday is in 2 days.
Oh, right,
December 23rd.
Yeah, so happy birthday, Adam. Yeah, it's scary to think that you'll be 31 years old in a couple of days' time. So celebrate it happily with your wonderful family in Greenwood, South Carolina. And, of course, I'm sure you've got great plans for the holiday as well. And in the meantime, back to the program.
Back
on the menu.
Well, now, I mean, this Ruby a Violette. I mean, when I read their bio on their webpage, I said, we have to get these girls on there.
We have to do it. And it turns out it allowed us to theme the first part of this program, because what would the festive season be without sweets and desserts and things like that? So let's listen to those Mercer girls and their business in New York City called Ruby a Violette.
We're talking to those Mercer girls. They're named Genji, Becca, and Heather Sue. And these girls make cookies. In fact, it's an honest-to-God true story as relayed on their website, the website for their company called Ruby a Violette, that they actually heard former neighbors say, those Mercer girls, they were all so smart, had such potential, and now they just make cookies? Welcome to the show, you three. And I laughed my way through your description of your all three of you on your website, which is that and the fact that you make these wonderful cookies and brownies that we ate up is why you're here. Welcome.
Oh, yeah. Jenna.
The question is, why do you make cookies? Tell us how you came about to set up this company.
We all love sweets. I have a particular addiction to sweets. And we went through New York City trying the best of everything, be it the eclair, the ice cream, chocolate chip cookies, and brownies. And by far and away, we love these cookies the best. And when we found out that they were going to close, we immediately decided we would pool our money and purchase it and dove right in to enormously long days of making batter and scrubbing pots, mopping, baking, packaging. And it was really a feet to the flames kind of learning experience, but we figured it out and learned how to make cookies and have since created about 60 new flavors.
Now, did we actually make the link between the Mercer girls and Ruby a Violette? I'm not sure we did. Who'd like to explain that one?
Well, the Ruby a Violette was a pre-existing stop in Hell's Kitchen in New York City, where we're still located, and it was named after the previous owner's daughters. And we kept the name because it had name recognition when we bought it.
Sure.
And we kept the kind of basis for the original 50-some-odd recipes that existed when we purchased the store, but we changed everything else. We redid the logo, the image, the packaging, We added 60-plus new recipes, plus, and a lot of the flavors have been modified, and we also have a line of cookie dough ice creams now, which is one of our favorite things to be able to do. Things like champagne strawberry cookie dough ice cream, and fundamentally the favorite. So each cookie that you see, we haven't made all of them, obviously. We have about a dozen flavors right now of different ice creams. So
now, of course, you had a wonderful academic preparation for this, right? one of you has a master's in English and one in biology.
And a law degree.
So this is
a law degree is the only one that comes handy.
So what about Becca and Gingy? Gingy admits to completing college but doesn't say what she was doing there.
No, Genji is the one with the law degree from Georgetown.
Oh, okay.
Genji handles all of the legal issues, all the correspondence, all of the nitty-gritty work that has to be done to keep a business running.
And according to your website, she also now does the mopping.
Well, that's true. Actually, when we first bought the... This is Genji speaking right now. And when we first bought the space in 2006, it was really only Heather Sue and myself in the actual bakery because Becca had a brand new baby. And with my second baby, I was there with him around my neck in a sling daily. Yeah, constantly used to think that we were torturing her in the back, that she had to be in the shop with a brand new baby in a sling. Most people get maternity leave, but I had none.
Oh, wow.
Now, at the beginning, we didn't have any other employees, so it was us, Heather Sue, and myself, Genji. And between the two of us, we made our 25-pound vats of batter, and I did all the mopping, all the cleaning.
Oh, wow. My
sister, who still is not allowed to boil water, that she might kitchen down, has turned out to be a cookie genius, and she can tell you when she tastes the cookie what it's missing, the ratio of flour to sugar is off in some way, or there's not enough butter.
She's amazing.
While I was mopping, that's what she learned.
Right. Now, are your customers, cookie customers or brownie customers, are they as crazy as cupcake customers?
Some of them, I mean, we're not that familiar with cupcake customers.
They have a whole blog thing going that...
They become very passionate about getting their cupcakes.
We
closed down for a longer period than expected to do all the renovations and restructuring and reimagining that we wanted to do, and we got very irate, at sometimes bordering on nasty even. I mean, I don't mean nasty, but like, they were
hostile.
We would get these emails saying, "What's going on? How come you've been shut for so long? Can't you send us cookies? I understand that the cafe has to be closed, but can't you bake them from home and send them in? How long are you going to be closed?" So we definitely felt the pressure of being closed. We had a lot of customers because our customers are amazing and they're so loyal. We had one customer in particular who would come in from Brooklyn every day to get her one cookie, and she would take and have it with her tea every night. And we're very, very fortunate with our customer base.
Now, do you sell through Bake Shop and Cafe? Do you also do internet orders?
Yes, the majority of our business is internet and corporate orders.
Oh, you do corporate too?
Yes, we do a lot of corporate gifting. A lot of companies in town want to use us when they have meetings or if they have clients coming in. They want a box of our cookies in the hotel room to greet them when they arrive. And our cafe is really for the neighborhood and so that people have a solid place, an existing place to go and visit us and see us. And also, in the cafe, you can get our homemade line of drinking chocolates and ice creams, which are not always available easily through delivery. So I think that our cafe is somewhat of a destination spot for people who aren't familiar with it. And then we have our loyal locals who come in every day or every other day. And, you know, they live right there around the area. And, for instance, we have customers who come from Canada, from California, from Florida, having read about us in a travel guide or a magazine or seen us on the Food Network, and they've made it a destination. It's one of the places on their list of things to see in New York because they're foodies. They love good food, and they want to experience a red velvet cookie, an eggnog cookie. And we had a woman come in from Florida the other day who got a red velvet, an eggnog, and a pumpkin, and just snarfed them down immediately and was just in heaven.
Yeah, they're generously sized, too, I must say.
Yeah, but there are some unconventional flavors, I guess. There was a champagne Kier cookie, and there was one you called, was it Monday Night Football?
Monday Night Football, that's one of the...
couldn't quite understand the connection to Monday Night Football, but it did taste good. And then Anne missed the chocolate one with the salt on it, with the sea salt on it.
Oh, did I understand?
You missed that one. That was the last one, because Anne likes caramel and chocolate with sea salt. Now, what's that one called? I've forgotten.
First Kiss. That's one of my favorites.
First Kiss. Okay, there you go.
First Kiss. Uh-huh. See, this is it. There's so much wit and intelligence to your operation. You draw people in, and I think it's a great operation.
And what are those Mercer girls going to do next?
Yes.
Our dream is to introduce the cookie to America and the world in general as a gourmet food item. Most people see the cookie as something you just pick up in a deli, and it's sort of the throwaway snack of the day or the thing they just grab at the cashier. And the cookie is a decadent, indulgent dessert and can really be enjoyed and experienced in a fantastic way. And there's so many different experiences to have, from the root beer float to the toasted coconut stuck on you, creme de menthe. There's something for everyone, and it's fun, and it's different, and people enjoy it.
And it can be customized. I just ordered a cookie from somebody local for my UPS driver.
Oh, really?
Yes. So it's going to be a Santa sleigh with UPS on the side.
Yeah, we know he's a chocolate-holic because we feed him chocolate samples all the time. I'm thinking of those. You remember those cookies we got from somewhere in Vermont? They were all vegan, but they didn't taste like it. And they were wonderful, but they were $4 a piece.
Yeah, are yours like that, too?
No, there must be a little bit of sticker shock involved in ordering them online.
Yeah, well, there's definitely, because people have that preconceived notion of the deli cookie, the Toll House cookie, these are not your average cookies. We import our ingredients from Europe. We use only the best of everything, and all of our cookies and brownies and ice creams are completely handmade. There are no machines involved in dropping the cookies because, quite frankly, there's simply too much stuff in each of the cookies, literally. We looked into having an automatic dropper because an enormous amount of labor to scoop each cookie, weigh each cookie, and bake each cookie, which you have to do because each cookie bakes at a different temperature and for a different amount of time. And so enormous amount of attention has to be paid to every step of the process, and it's not something that a machine can do. We wish it were, but unfortunately it's not, and because we love what we do, we're willing to do it.
Well, this is absolutely fabulous. I was going to ask a final question. What did the men in your lives think about the fact that you're in the cookie business?
Oh, I've gotten several proposals when people find out that I make cookies.
And perhaps Becca has a husband.
I do, and he loves it, of course.
But your kids
well,
love
this,
it.
Well, this is something.
Don't bring more cookies home, but of course the answer is obvious.
Well, I don't know whether you call this a stocking stuffer or the last gift under the tree, but
no,
it seems like a great idea. Let's do the website before we forget.
Is somebody going to tell us the website?
Yes, it's www.rubyaviolette.com. That's RubyAviolette.com.
Right, and it's subtitled "The Best Chocolate Chip Cookies and Brownies Anywhere." Well, we conclude with just telling our listeners that do themselves a favor to check out these cookies and brownies, and would ask you, Mercer Girls, to keep us posted on any new developments.
We definitely will. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, I think they have quite a good time.
It sounds like a laugh a minute with those Mercer girls.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, let's now take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. We're entering into the sweet spot again in our menu.
Are we going to do email and blog?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yes. Okay, all right.
We almost forgot that.
Okay, email us, please, at onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com. You can send comments, yeah. Season's greetings.
And if you've got anything special that you'd like to blog about, you can join us at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com and see if we can get something going with a little controversy, possibly.
I think that's what makes it fires all the blogs.
Is that what it does? So please.
I don't know that we're all that controversial.
I think that's probably why there's not as much activity on the blog as we would like. But we're going to keep on going, and we hope that you'll join us. And who's up next? We're on sweets again, I think, aren't we?
Yes, and it's. Again, the name of the baked is also the name of the shop, Baked. And listen to the conversation with the owners, and it's very interesting.
Matt Lewis and Renato Poliafito, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, you guys ditched the day job. You were in advertising and web design and things like that to go into a bake shop. You set up a bake shop. Did you do a first one, or is this the one in Brooklyn, the first one, called Baked?
Brooklyn is the first incarnation of Baked, and it will be the first one in the flagship. Prior to this, I had a store called Chocolate Bar, where we actually didn't manufacture or make anything on premises.
Okay.
It was just kind of, we sold the best at that time. The chocolatiers that we could find.
Now, the title of this book, which is what we're talking about, is Baked, which is the name of your bake shop. I'm interested in your subtitle here called New Frontiers in Baking. What does that mean?
Well, I can answer that. This is Renato. It's a little tongue-in-cheek. If you ever came by Baked, you'd see that the decor is a little ski lodgy, a little New Frontiers-y. We have wood walls. We have taxidermied animals and
oh, that's a hoot.
Yeah, so it looks almost like a modern ski lodge, a modern frontiers lodge. And then, you know, it speaks to the recipes in the book as well. We really have a bunch of classic American recipes that we tried to modernize slightly, put a new spin on them by adding ingredients that wouldn't find in that recipe originally, and then try to punch up flavors here and there. So in a way, it's like the recipes are on that new frontier, kind of like leading the way.
But this is a comfort food lineup of recipes, isn't it?
I think it's a traditionally comfort food recipe. I think one of the things Nato and I always discuss, always kind of keep at the forefront, is that we really wanted American desserts to be just as well represented as their French counterparts, which if you a couple, 10, 20 years ago, any dessert shop or any bakery was focused really on the French dessert.
Right.
And the trend in the last 10 years, due to many, many items, many things happening, would be that now American desserts are kind of emblematic of a cupcake, which we find kind of just horrifying. We like cupcakes. We think they're wonderful. We think they're really great. But I think that I would hate for American desserts to be represented just by the cupcake. So we wanted our bakery to represent really great American desserts. Comfort food in a way, but we also feel like they're very artisanal. Everything we create here is thought out from the ingredients to the handcraftedness.
Yeah, well, you have good credentials in your Jacques Torres. Says a new American classic, and then you have sort of a quizzical one by Martha Stewart.
Yes.
I'm not sure I get that.
Martha's really been, this is Matt again, Martha's been really fantastic to us. She was really a pioneer of bait in our very infancy. I mean, and Oprah also kind of...
She loves your brownie, right?
A big fan of the brownies.
She's a big fan of the brownies. But yeah, Martha was really interested in why we're using root beer, why we're using green tea powder or matcha powder, why we're using malt. She finds a lot of that very interesting. And not every recipe in the book uses a unique or unusual ingredient, but the ones that did, she loved.
Now this is not just a cookbook. It's a sort of a little bit of a life story. I mean, before you came on the air, we were talking about the fact that you must have met in the insane asylum because you had good regular jobs and you decided to throw it all in and open a bake shop.
I actually agree with you. We are a little bit crazy.
You were ready to open, but the shop wasn't ready, but you still had all these orders, so you had to try and fill all these orders.
Yeah. It was terrible. At one point, we were wrapping blondies, which was not really the most specific recipe we wanted to create. It was delicious. But we wrapped how many blondies at my house?
Oh, thousands of blondies during like a couple of weeks before Christmas. Before we opened, we had a client that wanted to do not catering, but corporate gifts. And they ordered, I think, about 5,000 blondies.
We just
made tray after tray after tray and cut and wrapped.
In a home oven.
That's
disgusting. That's really awful.
Now, you must have a saint watching over you, though, because you say very clearly in the book how lucky we are that after 4 or 5 months in business, Oprah Winfrey discovered us, and then a few months after that, Martha Stewart discovered our sugar and salt. Is it the sugar and salt
cake? Sweet and salty cake. Became one of our most popular cakes.
I can understand why. I mean, I think even Anne would like that.
Which one is that?
Well, she doesn't like desserts all that much, but she does like salt on caramels.
Salted caramel.
Yeah. And I think you would find a lot of our desserts, and again, represented in the book, we take out they're less sweet than the traditional American desserts. We travel all the time for various things, and we notice that a lot of desserts are just, unfortunately, all you taste is sugar, so
right.
You kind of lose the flavorings of any fruits that have been infused or any chocolate or cocoa powder. We wanted, not to transform the American palate. I mean, we're not, I guess, that big of egomaniacs, but we thought that, again, this is what dessert should taste like. You should be able to taste the other flavors, and if you put too much sugar in them, you can't.
It just overpowers everything.
But you did take some of the whiskey out of one of the recipes.
We did. Actually, two of them.
Two of them.
Has a pecan pie, bourbon pecan pie that we've been using forever. And when we first got it, it just tasted like bourbon. So we had to play with that. And then there's a really fantastic recipe called Tuscaloosa Toll House Pie.
That's the one I saw.
Yeah, and that's really traditionally a Southern dessert. I mean, we haven't really seen it anywhere in the North.
No, we haven't.
Or Northeast. And I actually found it when I was going to school at University of Alabama.
Oh, so that's your connection to the South. I was going to ask you that.
It was a really strange thing how I ended up there, but I ended up in the University of Alabama. My mom had gone there, I think, for 6 months. She was the first Northeast Italian woman to attend the university, and she dropped out quickly thereafter. It didn't really sit well with her, but I ended up going there. I finished school there, and my next door neighbor made this Tuscaloosa Toll House pie that just blew me away. It's a very sweet dessert,
mm-hmm.
and he would just put a half a bottle of whiskey, it felt like, into the pie.
Yeah.
They like whiskey down there.
Well, my mother used to make a Christmas cake that the only liquid ingredient was old granddad.
Now, what I will do, guys, if you're interested, I can put you in touch with Frederick Bookerno III, who is the current bourbon ambassador for Jim Beam.
Oh, wow.
Like his father and his father before him, and he's actually going to be on a program, I think, that was a week or two ago, because he was here in Pittsburgh and we caught up with him, and I think it's a recipe he'd love to have, and he'd like to correspond with you about it. So
put him in touch with us.
Oh yeah, we would love to.
Yeah, stay on at the end of the interview so we make sure we get a direct email address for you.
Absolutely.
Now, is it true what they say about the University of Alabama, that they had to take iced tea off the menu because they lost the recipe?
I think that's an old wives' tale.
That was an old wives' tale that originated at Auburn University, I believe.
I think you're correct.
I'm not sure. No, your mother, was she born in Italy?
No. She was born in Schenectady, New York.
Well, why was she
my
so odd?
And then my parents were born in Italy.
Not his parents were born in Italy, but we both have Italian heritage.
Oh, okay. All right. So, Renata, what part of Italy are you?
My parents are actually from Sicily.
Oh, that's what my background.
Oh, really?
Now, that's some good desserts.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're very different than, falling into classic American, like trying to convince my mom about a red velvet cake or it's a little hard. But you know, my mom would be like, why not just do like a one-layer almond tort or something like that? And
well, you know, one thing I'd like to suggest to the listeners is that this is a book that you ought to buy before the holidays, because there are a lot of things in here that you could make, because we're all watching what we spend this year, as presents. I mean, I'm looking at these milk chocolate almond truffles, and they are drop-dead gorgeous.
Thank you, thank you.
They're in a nice box, and there you go.
They're really easy to make as well.
Well, now we should be careful here, because if you have the money and you don't want to try and make them from the book, you could also presumably order them. Do you take online orders as well at Baked?
We do take online orders. We have a website, www.bakedshop.com, and we sell our cookies and brownies, marshmallows, granola, items that are a little more shelf stable and travel, and then like cute little things that we sell here at the bakery, like T-shirts, mugs, and tote bags, things like that.
But for the truffles, you're going to have to make those at home or come to visit us in Brooklyn.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, we're our second store that we just opened up last week in Charleston, South Carolina.
Oh, no. Where are you in Charleston?
We're on East Bay Street.
Oh, fabulous. We
always do that festival.
Yeah, we know most of the restaurants down
East Bay.
In fact,
we're doing the festival right after this.
Program. You're going to be at the festival? Or?
Oh, yeah. We were there 2 years ago.
Oh, great. We'll be there as well. So.
Oh, then we can meet. That's great.
I look forward to it. Are you guys grit fans?
Only if they're Anson Mills and they're fixed just right with
hand-cut
with shrimp
ground.
And with shrimp or oysters would be fine, too.
Corn.
Wow. Yeah, you can't. We just like the cheese ones.
We just like the cheese ones. Okay. Well, if you want the ultimate recipe with grits, go to the
Charleston Grill.
I'm thinking of the ones that Bobby Carter does at Plantation mm-hmm. Inn, Peninsula Grill at the Plantation Inn.
Oh, right.
And he makes a chocolate. He makes a coconut cake that you should see.
Each slice weighs a pound.
Oh my goodness! We've heard many things about this coconut cake. We were a little intimidated too because we have our own at the bakery.
But we're not serving it right now.
We're not serving it yet because
well, this is humongous. I mean, it's really practically obscene.
We went there for dinner. We ate our way through it. Tasting menu, and then at the end they presented us with a one-pound piece of coconut cake.
Oh, my goodness.
and we had to take it with us, so we took it back to our hotel and gave it to the night clerk at the desk.
And I think it fed the whole hotel staff for the evening.
Who was absolutely thrilled to get...
Oh, that's great.
Well, it sounds like we have a date for grit at the Charleston...
Exactly. And I wanted to have you spell your website again, especially if it's B-A-K-E-D.
Yes, it's B-A-K-E-D, S-H-O-P, so Baked Shop is our online store. And then you could either go to bakedcharleston.com or bakednyc.com to check out our full website.
Well, that's great.
Great. Well, I bet you designed them, Renato, right?
I did.
There you go. Nothing.
I had some help this time around. I did the first version of the website, but... we've gotten so busy that as the website expanded, I solicited help from a small web agency in Tennessee, actually.
Wow. Well, we hope you'll have a wonderful holiday season.
Well, thank you.
And we'll look forward to catching up with you in Charleston. And listeners, the book, of course, is available on the OTM bookshelf. Just do a search, an edit, find on this page, B-A-K-E-D. Go through all the bakes, you'll find it, and you can order it in plenty of time to make things for Christmas.
Absolutely. Thank
Great.
You so much, guys.
Thanks so much,
okay.
guys.
So look forward to meeting you in person. And if you need to know even more about baking, let's talk to somebody who wrote a book telling you everything you ever wanted to know about pies, the complete books of pies.
And if you think you know everything about pies, listen to this interview and you'll realize that you don't, and probably you ought to have a copy and you certainly ought to follow the sage advice contained therein.
Julie Hassan has just completed her fifth book. She is a well-respected and fondly sought-out cookbook author. This one is one to treasure, called The Complete Book of Pies, because, as Julie explains, and she's going to explain to us now, she's trying to demystify this whole pie process. Welcome to On the Menu, Julie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Now, there are so many books out there. Why did you decide to write a book about pies?
Well, first of all, I absolutely love pies, so I just found that I get away from it, and I knew then that I had to write a book on pies. But one of the things that I really wanted to accomplish with this book was to help demystify the whole pie-making process, because I hear from so many people that they're really afraid to make pies, or they think they don't have time to make pies, or they're afraid of the crust. So I really try to go through and break down the process and try and make it as easy as possible for people, and have all kinds of tips and things throughout, and then even put in little shortcuts for certain recipes. You know, if you don't have time to make crust from scratch, this is a great place where, you know, you could use a good quality frozen organic crust.
Yeah, that was impressive that you included that possibility for somebody who's phobic about pie crust, as I am.
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of people are, and I know it's sort of taboo to use frozen crust, but I really don't think that it needs to be, and I think that there's some great quality ones out there now. And
what would you say would be a good quality one?
One of my favorites is Holy Wholesome. And they are available in a lot of health food stores or well-stocked grocery stores in the frozen section. And they taste great. They're organic. They have non-hydrogenated fats in them. And it's called Holy Wholesome.
Holy.
W-H-O-L-L-Y.
Oh, Holy Wholesome. Okay, not Holy.
Yeah, like an all wholesome. not with craters.
All together.
Not with craters. Now, I noticed in looking at the book that you also address the dietary requirements of vegans. Now, can you explain that? I mean, pies mostly have fruit in them, so where's the vegan breaking
the
thing
crust.
That's in? Oh, I see. Okay, well, go ahead, Julie.
The crust is one place where oftentimes you'll find eggs, dairy, but also a lot of fruit pies call for using butter. And although it, you know, in some pies I'm sure, you know, it tastes great, I really didn't find that it was necessary to add butter into, you know, apple pies and a lot of the fruit pies. And I'll probably get some letters from people that say, no, it's the best way. But I found that out additional things like butter actually in with the fruit, you just get a very pure taste, flavor with your pie. And I really just love it where the come out. So there were instances where, although you might think that a fruit pie wouldn't have dairy or eggs in it, that they often. So I wanted to label the recipes for people so that whether they were vegan or they have dairy or egg allergies or they're kosher, there's so many different reasons why somebody would seek out recipes that did not have those ingredients. So I thought I'd make it really easy and label them. And I think there's over 100 pies in the book that are vegan friendly.
Yeah, well, I was very impressed with that. And the other thing is I was very surprised when I got to this section where you covered you call the section fillings, but you cover ice cream.
Yes.
And I don't know, this one sounds good, bourbon fudge sauce.
Yeah. Well, that was something else that I hadn't seen in other pie books.
No, I've never seen it.
Yeah, where you can, you know, go above and beyond. So depending on how ambitious you might be feeling, that there's nothing better than taking a homemade pie and topping it with homemade ice cream and drizzling it with a sauce. Or even just something simply like making an icing to drizzle over your pie, it just takes it to an entirely different level.
Certainly does.
Now, Julie, you shared with us before we came on the air that one of the things that you particularly wanted to address with your tips was dealing with the season when fresh fruit is not available for pies, so you have to use frozen, and then there are things you need to do if you want the pie to be successful.
Yes, yes. You know what, the tips are really important because, you know, it just gives people a little more insight sometimes into some of the different techniques. And I like to, personally, just for my own pie-making strategies, it's really nice to just sort of read up and refresh yourself with some of the different tips and stuff before you make pies, and then it's nice as you're doing the pies, then you start to remember, like, oh yeah, that, you know, there's a shortcut for this, or this works really well if you make sure that, you know, your butter or your shortening has been chilled in the freezer ahead of.
Now you deal with savory pies as well.
Yes,
I was
very
disappointed you did not do a steak and kidney. That's a big hit in our house.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, I the savory pies are definitely sort of a fun component of pies, and I love that you can eat pies for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But I have to be totally honest, I am a fruit pie person.
Okay. So you don't have a recipe in for the universal Australian dish called a meat pie.
Meat pie.
Meat source of meat unspecified.
Oh no. No, and I have not had the privilege of having
They're really good, but they're not very good for the diet.
Yes.
Who knows what's in them?
Yeah, nobody. What's in them is what's called a mystery meat, I think.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think that above all, Julie, that I think anybody that gets a hold of this book will find their creativity stirred in this department of pies, because there's so many unusual combinations, so many things to explore, and each door then opens up to another possibility. So you did a great job on this.
Thank you. You know, I tried. I spent a lot of time on this book, and I wanted to make it as complete as possible, but although, I mean, there's always, it's endless how, I mean, I could have put 1,000 pies to truly be complete, but I felt like I hit a lot of different things, hit upon a lot of different things that I wanted to, and that would be, you know, bringing different fruits together, being able to use frozen fruits, and the shortcuts, and the toppings, and the savory pies, as well as tarts and hand pies. And
turnovers and all kinds of things, right. Well, it's called now The Complete Book of Pies, listeners, and the author is Julie Hasson, Hasson, and I'm sure you're going to find it on our website under OTM and Books.
If you shop the OTM bookshelf, you'll find it right there with the one click through to Amazon, and there's still time to get it for Christmas. I know Amazon keeps on writing to remind us, so I'm sure it must be ready. just the kind of thing to put under somebody's tree if they don't have a clue about making pies.
Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Let us know when you come out with your sixth book.
Oh, I will. I will. I better get working on it.
I guess you do.
Okay, bye, Julie.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye, Julie.
Bye.
And now it's time for a break.
Yeah, what we call a pause for the cause, and of course we hope you'll stay with us and join us again on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu. And we're going to be listening next to Amanda Hesser talk about her currently available new book and about the one that she's been working on for, I forget what she said, like 5 years or so. But anyhow, let's hear what she says.
Amanda Hesser, columnist for the New York Times Magazine, has come out with a really nifty book called Eat Memory. Hello, morning, Amanda.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming here and talking to us about this book. Tell us what this is. It's a collection of essays, and it's built around a certain concept. Could you explain the concept?
Yes, well, essentially, you know, I had been a food reporter and editor at the New York Times for a decade, and a lot had sort of changed at the newspaper in the way we covered food, and I felt like we'd actually covered it in a more expansive and thorough way than, you know, previous decades, and but the one thing that I felt as a reader that was missing was the kind of personal experience with food, the relationship that we all have with memory as kind of a way of kind of dog-earing, you know, important moments of our life, and the way that, you know, food plays into our emotional life and, you know, everyday experiences.
A sort of variation on where were you when.
Kind of, yeah. Because the thing that is interesting about food is it is a way of kind of marking points in your memory, and I think it is for most people, and it doesn't mean that, you know, it's some fancy meal, but, I mean, it could be something as simple as a hot dog, but it's, I think because it, you know, because food engages all of your senses, it's a very kind of powerful way of bringing back a specific moment in your life.
Houston Blumenthal is actually working on how to control this, because it's one of those things that he thinks interacts with your or causes your reaction to certain dishes.
Oh, yeah.
Your food memory.
Yeah.
But he tells of, he used something with, what was it now? Like some kind of, not tree sap, what is it? Anyhow, it turns out that it reminded some people of, like, happy childhoods, and it reminded somebody else of latex dental gloves. So, if he had known that in advance.
Yeah.
So he took that one off. He took that one off the menu. Now, Amanda, the essays that you assembled for the book, they were actually written by other people, many of whom are names we would recognize.
Yes. So the other, so the kind of other aspect that sort of, you know, led to this column, which was called Eat Memory, and it's also the title of the book, is that, you know, everyone sort of has a great food story, and this is something I learned just being a food writer, because everyone is constantly telling me their, you know, their food tales, which is great. But I thought that, you know, rather than kind of just having, you know, food writers, you know, writing essays, wouldn't it be great to have people who, work we know and love, you know, people who, are great, just great writers, you know, novelists, playwrights, screenwriters, poets, have them contribute stories, and I was actually kind of delighted by the response, because I sort of, you know, thought, well, this is a fun idea, but will a novelist really want to take time to write a story about food?
And
the other thing that was kind of important to me, because I really do believe this, and I think M.F.K. Fisher is a great example of this, is that M.F.K. Fisher's work is a great example of this, is that, you know, most great food stories aren't really focused on the food. It's, you know, food is kind of a way to, an entry point for the story,
right.
You know, or something to sort of pivot the story on. And I think that, you know, the writers who I contacted really kind of immediately got that, and as a result, it brought in a really kind of varied, wonderful collection of stories that aren't just kind of obsessing about food, but are really about, you know, relationships and life.
I enjoyed the one about the couple who were at Talavant in Paris, spending huge amounts of money and apparently falling out with each other, and they said they really didn't say anything about the food at all.
Yeah, I really, that was a fantastic story. It was by Ann Patchett, who's a novelist.
Yeah,
and
brilliant.
She really, I mean, everyone has had, you know, an incredible argument at the table, because it's often when we sort of sit and, you know, engage with each other, and when, you know, difficult moments can occur, and, you know, she... For her, it happened at, you know, this incredibly fancy restaurant in Paris, and, you know, this giant bill lands on the table, and at that point she realizes, oh my God, I don't remember a single thing about what we just ate.
I can remember the experience of bills landing with a thud on the table.
Yes, can't we all?
Yeah. So tell us about some of the other, I call them characters, but they're personalities, I guess.
Yeah.
But they're stories.
Well, you know, the thing that was... sort of struck me about the stories is that often, you know, people's food memories are associated with, you know, not necessarily like the happiest moments in your life, but difficult times, struggles, or, you know, sort of mournful moments. And I mean, it's not like a sad, sad collection of stories, but it's very moving and powerful. I mean, I would say like the you know, Chang Rae Lee writes about... his mother dying.
That was very good. Yeah,
of cancer, and how he was, you know, at that point he was young and had just changed careers from being on Wall Street to trying to become a novelist, which was, you know, kind of a shock to his parents, and he really was at this moment of having to prove himself while also dealing with his mother's you know, fading health.
Yeah, it was stomach cancer, wasn't it?
Yes. And, you know, he was cooking for her. He was kind of cooking a lot for himself as a way of, I think, kind of tucking away his emotions. And he watched his Babette's Feast. And at some point, Babette said something like, you know, when you have art, you know, one is never poor. And it just, you know, kind of hits home for him and is a kind of turning point for him. But then, you know, there are also stories like George Saunders wrote this kind of send-up of Americans and their kind of weird relationship with food, and he wrote a story about how he supposedly stopped eating 4 years before but gained 70 pounds. and he included a recipe called Light as Air Brunch.
That was funny. Yeah.
Which called for various expensive ingredients and also 6 cubic feet of air, and you shop for all the ingredients and you bring them home, and then you mix the bowl of air, and then you return all the ingredients to the store, and you're left with your bowl of air.
That's good. You're moving on, of course. One must always move on to a new project.
Yes.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, this project, actually, I've been working on for 5 years, so Eat Memory was kind of an in-between project, and it's a New York Times cookbook, and many people are familiar with the Craig Claiborne edition, which came out in 1961.
Yeah, I told you I have that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book, and, you know, it's a classic.
I think it's curry.
Do you? Yeah. Which curry? Because he has a couple
of
them.
Yeah, I mean, I think I scribbled in the book, added to the sambals, too, so I think it was it? I can't remember. Is there a lamb curry or a chicken curry or something?
I believe there's a lamb curry.
It's not vegetarian curry.
Okay.
There's a lamb curry. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the kind of book that, you know, people have a relationship with it like you do, and it, you know, it continues to sell. And originally, actually, when I set out to do the book, I meant to kind of do an sort of like an update, like sort of taking his book and then, you know, adding all the great things that have been published in the Times since. And then I started researching the Times recipe archives and discovered that, in fact, the Times has been publishing recipes since the 1850s.
That's amazing.
And also had published a cookbook in the in 1875.
Wow.
And they had there's an enormous amount of food stories and recipes from the 19th century. And so I just felt like, you know, well, wouldn't it be great to kind of do this retrospective of recipes from today back through the 1850s that ran in the Times as a kind of snapshot of, you know, the evolution of cooking and eating in America. And so it's it's been a big project. And
I've
made 1,200 recipes now. And, you know, and now sort of finally finishing that book, which will be out next year.
I just read the it's not a novel, it's a, not a memoir either, a book about Paddleford, what's her name?
Oh, Clementine Paddleford,
Clementine.
Yeah.
Who did she write for, the Post?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So that was interesting, too, because I mean, she really went out on a limb for her era.
Oh, she really did, yeah.
And she's never gotten any recognition at all, I mean, until now.
Which is amazing, just simply because also her name, like, she has such an unforgettable name.
Yes.
And yet people did kind of forget about her for a while.
Right. Well, she was outshined by Julia Child and James Beard, right?
Yes, probably, and also probably Craig. Simply, you know,
and Craig.
Her, you know, because she worked for what essentially was a local paper,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, I'm very sad every time I think of Craig Claiborne after reading Gail Green's autobiography about how he ended up. It was so sad, huh?
Yes, yeah.
So did you know him?
I did not.
I mean, he ended up bitter and bitchy and, you know, all kinds of stuff. Very sad.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that that this is a successful project for you.
Oh, thanks. I hope so, too.
I got the Gourmet Cookbook, revised issue. And first of all, I can't read it because all the headlines are in yellow. I don't know who was supervising production. But and then I started noting what my favorite recipes were from the original ones, the two-volume thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many that are missing in the new one. And there are all kinds of things that are coming back, like steak and kidney pie is gone. And,
yeah.
And now that's coming back, so you can't be too trendy. Anyway.
Yeah, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah, okay. Well, anything else that you'd like to tell our listeners about this book, Amanda?
I think it's a nice collection, and with, you know, really terrific writers, and I think it's really different from other food essay collections out there.
It certainly is. It really is great, and I mean, the level of writing is amazing.
And good luck with your 1850 onward project.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Maybe you'll go back to colonial times and do a squirrel stew as well.
First catch a squirrel, right?
Exactly.
Anyhow, Amanda, thank you again for joining us and On the Menu, and hopefully we'll talk to you when your next book's out.
Oh, terrific. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And finally, for today's program, the return of an old friend.
A mate.
a cobber would be the official expression.
A cobber,
in Australia, a cobber. Jeremy Meltzer's family owns a large olive plantation, I guess you'd call it, olive farm, in Victoria, in Tasmania. I mean, in Australia. What am I talking about? Tasmania. I don't know what. Getting my states mixed up here. But Jeremy's always trying to come up with some brilliant new ideas, and
we think
he caught one, and we'll just listen to our conversation so he can explain it to us.
Well, we always like on the menu to welcome back a friend, and that's what I would call Jeremy Meltzer of Yelling Bow Gold olive oil, right?
spit it out, dear.
Yelling Bow Gold extra virgin olive oil, and I was delighted, Jeremy, to hear about and get to try your new packaging cask.
Thank you.
It's basically like wine in a box, isn't it?
Yeah, it's it's based on the Australian wine cask. It's sort of a cute little story as to how we found this, actually.
Okay.
We hand pick our olives because we're a small estate. And in order to get the label, we have to bribe our friends and family with a big lunch to have them to come up and pick on the farm. So one particular afternoon during the harvest, just a few months back, we had a big picnic for about 50 people underneath the trees, and I realized a bottle of oil would not be enough for everyone's lunch. So I ran up to the house, and there was an old wine cask, an empty one, sitting on the kitchen cabinet. And I thought, why don't I just throw a couple of litres of oil into that, and at least that'll be a great canister. I can carry the oil down to the grove. And then I did that and pulled the tap off and filled it with some oil and put the tap back on and carried it down. And I watched people pouring it over their pasta and salads and sandwiches, and I thought, this could be really interesting because it's. I realized no air or light can get into this packet, which is what makes olive oil rancid. And when those people don't realize, olive oil goes rancid very, very quickly when exposed to air and light. So this thing protects it completely from all oxygen and all light.
Well, that's wonderful.
So then you hooked up. Then you had to go hook up with somebody who makes these boxes for wine producers.
Yeah, we did. We found out who the producers were, and the actual people who make the cask is one of our recyclers. So it's already made of recycled material. The outside cask. And then it's 100% recyclable. So they've actually done tests on this packaging. Compared to a tin of oil, which a lot of people still have in their homes, it minimizes environmental impact by 95%. Because a tin's, if you imagine a tin, first of all, it fills with oxygen as you use it. And there's often oxygen in tin already when the tin is closed. So often these oils are rancid before you even open them.
Okay,
and then the tin ends up rusting as landfill. So from that perspective, environmentally, it's a far advance as well.
Now, for those people who were in the dark ages, you know, hiding behind something for the last 20 years and have never seen a wine box, why don't you just describe the components?
The components of a wine cask is essentially there's an internal bladder, and that collapses as the product is used. So that doesn't allow any air to get in at any point. And the outside is essentially, in its most basic form, it's a box. It's a cardboard box. But the contents are entirely sealed in the bladder. In our case, we had this company develop and test this bladder for olive oil. So it's gone through all these stringent testings, and there's no transference of the plastic, but it's a very strong and safe internal bladder, which is basically sits in the inside the box. And there's a little drip-proof tap with different flow rates, so it's a very clean. I mean, I'm sure everyone's had the experience of their tin of oil or even bottle of oil. Eventually, it gets quite greasy on the outside.
Oh, yes.
And messy, you know, and often you lose quite a bit of it. You're dripping, and it's messy, and the label gets ruined, and all the rest. And this is
and in summer, it gets ants.
Summer attracts ants. And that's another advantage of this. It's completely clean. I mean, it has a little drip-proof tap, which doesn't allow it to drip on your counter as soon as you close it. It actually closes by pushing out the last drop, so it's quite a clever patented tap in Australia.
What do you mean it closes by pushing out the last drop?
Well, it has a mechanism whereby when you close it, it actually pushes out the last drop. That's the way it seals.
Oh,
dear. So you can't close it and then it'll start dripping like the last few drops. It actually closes by pushing out that last drop. So it's not going to drip or leak at all. And also at the same time, won't allow any air in. So it's very, very user-friendly.
Now, has anybody copied this so far? I mean, do you think you've started a trend?
I think we have. I mean, I suspect it'll be copied. I mean, we can't patent it because it already exists as a wine cask in Australia, but we're definitely the first to offer it in the US as for families, and we wanted to give families, especially given the economic situation in the country, where we thought, what if we could offer... I mean, you know how when you go to an olive oil shelf, you know, most people, including myself, are overwhelmed by what's on the shelf. I mean, people don't know where to start, what's good oil, what isn't. So often they're just shopping based on, you know, they think all the Italians make the best oils, and they just look for price. And, you know, what's unique in Australia, we have so much land and so few people, we're creating some really beautiful premium oils that are now being sold all over the world.
I might just put in a plug here, listeners. This happens to be an excellent oil, even without the packaging.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very much hand-picked, cold-pressed, made on our family farm. And as I was saying, I thought it'd be wonderful if we could offer people really good value, because if you work it out on a per litre basis, what people are paying for good oil in a retail store, they're sort of paying often between $40 and $60 a litre for good olive oil, which is a lot of money. And so I realised, why don't we develop this packaging and offer it to families at really great value who love to cook and use olive oil every day. And so that's why we set up this website where they can get it direct from our grove to their home.
And what is the website?
The website is, yellingbo.com, Y-E-L-L-I-N-G-B-O. Yellingbo.com, and it comes to your door at basically at chef's wholesale prices.
Well, that's wonderful news.
Yeah, that's really good.
Well done.
I didn't know about the wholesale prices.
And,
that's good.
So we're glad to have you once again back on the program. And Jeremy, when you invent something else new, you'll be sure to dial us in and let us know.
We haven't got to the bottom of this, so I haven't been able to test it. But do you have to tip that when you get low? Because I'm wine. I always end up when I had lice tea.
You know what the mechanism. You know what the mechanism is, because my cheap brother taught me this. What you do when you're almost finished is you rip open the box, you take the bladder out, and then you squeeze the bladder. So you get the last few drops.
You might have to do that, but I mean, we've done tests so that the tap's as low as possible. So literally, if you tilt it over, you'll get 98% of it will come out. If I can just add as well, the oils are kosher certified, which we did recently, and also we support a foundation for orphan children, which we set up after being caught in the tsunami in India. December 26 is actually the anniversary of the 4 years since this occurred, and we give 5% of profits back to the Jasmine Foundation.
That's great, and you're still doing that. Well, you're doing
right on all counts. You're green, you're charitable, you're philanthropic.
Yeah, the only thing that's happening is your voice over IP connection's not really very good right now. So, listeners, if you are interested in a technology observation, this can be what voice over IP sounds like. So be sure you try it before you buy it.
Oh, yeah.
Jeremy, don't mind us. We're goofy today.
You have a wonderful... Are you going to be back in Australia for the holidays?
I'm going to be back in early January. And so I've been away for a few months now, but I'll be back soon. And what we've done in this 4-litre cask is $200 worth of olive oil. And up until December 31, we've actually made it even cheaper than the price the chefs are getting it. And you can buy it direct for $65.
Wow.
There you go.
That's a really great thing.
You're contributing to economic recovery already, Jeremy, without even realizing it.
Good.
thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Ciao, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me again. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
It sounds like On the Menu is getting kind of tongue-tied today. Tongue-tied, indeed.
But just in case
you're wondering, Jeremy was not at the end of a tunnel, but he did say he was using his computer as the means for delivering voice over IP. So if there's a little bit of echo in there, unfortunately there wasn't anything we could do about it, and we'll suggest to you whether or not you might want to explore using that technology. So of course you heard it here first on the Menu Radio, because we're first with everything.
Yeah, well, we're going to be first to say this has been a good hour program here, and we had fun,
and of course we wish you and yours a very happy holiday. Again, a final greeting to Adam on his birthday on the 23rd. And Mrs. Rabbit?
Yes.
That's it. So what do we do at the end of the program? We say
bye-bye.